I'm Olivia Fitzpatrick. I'm originally from Ohio, and I'm currently a PhD student studying clinical psychology at Harvard University. There's a lot of different pieces to my identity, I would say, but I'll focus on the professional one here. So I kind of hold a bunch of different roles as a student. So I'm a therapist, a scientist, a mentor, data analyst, student, and kind of all these roles are really connected to my overarching goal to contribute to improving the benefits and accessibility of mental health care for families.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jonathan Jacob, and I'm originally from Jakarta, Indonesia, though I've lived in the U.S. For half of my life. I am a PhD student at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis, studying social policy and sociology. My research interest lies in labor inequalities, and specifically I'm focusing on how do people perceive the value of their own work, their labor, you know, and I'm seeing this in the context of how in society there could be high prestige jobs with high wages, high prestige with low wages, you know, and vice versa. And how are those pay differentials justified? So, yeah.
Wow. Thank you both so much. Yeah, I'm so excited to be able to spend a little more time with you both now that, you know, our Global Citizen Seminar has concluded. And as you both just shared, you're doing such interesting and important work. And we didn't really get to talk about this during the seminar, but I always wanted to ask you sort of what inspired you to get into the fields that you are in now. And I know, John, before you started your doctoral program, you were also at one time teaching right in a school, working with youth. And then Olivia, as you shared, you are doing so many things all at once. So just, yeah, if you can share a little bit about where those interests started, you know, at what time in your lives, or how did you end up where you are now?
Yeah, so I did work at the high school, public high school system in California. I think what prompted me, you know, there's a multitude of reasons, but one is that I, as an educator, it was very heartbreaking to see the sorts of failures at the institutional setting. And it was later on that I thought this ought to be taken at a policy level, which is what launched me here. But really, I think it's also very human to see just the sorts of inequalities that exist in society, and this urge to want to understand it more and, you know, if I'm lucky, propose some sort of solution to alleviate some of these inequalities. So, and a petty reason is I was told all my life that, you know, I wasn't smart in school, and you know, I applied to jobs and I was told that I'm unqualified. So I thought, you know what, why don't I get the highest degree out there possible?
Yeah. Wow. I definitely didn't know about that last part. And yeah, I would have, yeah, that thought has never crossed my mind, or I'm sure any of the minds of the people here. But I love that you use that as not like a reason to feel sorry for yourself or look down on yourself, but actually as like fuel for you to pursue something that actually is going to create so much value for many people who may have felt the way that you did. So that's really, really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I love that, John. Thank you. Yeah, so I would say there were kind of a lot of factors that went into my decision to pursue my current field. I think a broad theme is kind of observing that gaining access to tools that really promote emotional and behavioral well-being can have a really positive trajectory, or change trajectories in a positive way for individuals, their family systems, communities. And head nod to John's work. Of course, you know, mental health promotion is like not the only piece of the puzzle. So of course, like in and of itself, it's not a silver bullet, you know, that can directly kind of fix these systemic issues or stressors that are beyond our control. And at the same time, I think, you know, when we gain access to these tools that empower us to really cope with these stressors in ways that we're proud of. We get closer to our goals and the versions of ourselves that we really want to be, which I think can, you know, improve our lives and also the lives of people around us. So I really love working with families in particular, because oftentimes, you know, the driving force of a family seeking mental health care is for the child's emotional and behavioral well-being. And through the course of therapy, we do tend to see improvements, not only in the child's functioning and well-being, but also in the family system as a whole. We're really able to kind of like provide families with the space to get curious about kind of themselves, generational cycles, what they might want to do differently in their own home. And I think that kind of ultimately allows families to grow together. So I think that's why I think my field is valuable and kind of what I'm hoping to contribute to in making these tools a bit better and more accessible.
Yeah, thank you so much, Olivia, for sharing. I just was thinking back on my own experience in middle school and high school. And of course, I did some of my schooling in Asia, where, you know, mental health was not spoken about at all. And like the idea of like a family seeking out like therapy or support, in my mind, I'm like, oh, wow, that would never happen in my family. You know, it would be almost something like to feel ashamed of. I wonder, like, have you had to navigate that at all?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the question. And I have a few thoughts. First of all, you mentioned middle school, and middle school is totally like the Wild West. So I see a lot of middle schoolers, but also kids on the whole kind of developmental spectrum. And yeah, it's a really great point. And I think definitely something that I experienced growing up, where I'm from, there isn't a lot of mental health care or like talk about emotional well-being at all. I don't remember any point during my educational time where that was ever touched upon. It's very stigmatized from where I'm from and probably still is. Something really exciting is that I do think that the generation kind of behind mine, of the younger generation, are really opening this floor for more of a cultural shift. And that's really exciting. I think one thing that we are observing is then kind of this clash, like a generational clash, which we can see in a lot of different things. But, you know, kids and teens really talking about these issues, older generations maybe not being as comfortable because they weren't given the space to do that. So kind of that clash. So I think, you know, hopefully moving forward, what I'd love to see is having more integration of these kind of social and emotional learning tools in schools from the get-go, kind of try to contribute to that more cultural shift. Of course, that's an ideal goal, and we might see it in some places more than others. But those are a few of my thoughts to your good question.
Thank you so much, Olivia. When I think about the Global Citizen Seminar at the center that you both participated in, both of you are doing so much work and many different things and are very busy. And so I was wondering if you can share a little bit about what motivated you to be part of a seminar that maybe seems a little bit unrelated to the work that you're doing. And, you know, of course, there were other students who participated from very different backgrounds as well. And yeah, sort of how that experience was like for you being part of the seminar here at the center.
So, you know, I'll be honest, I learned about the seminar through a friend. Shout out to Sakshi, and I'll do like anything Sakshi says to do. So I honestly didn't know much about the center's mission and didn't know what to expect from the seminar at all, really. But based on what Sakshi shared, you know, it sounded like it aligned with kind of my goal of trying to find more spaces where I could kind of have these real discussions with people and conversations with people that are maybe thinking about their own work, their life, where they're fitting in the world in a similar way as me. You know, I think I was kind of seeking that because I wasn't feeling super jazzed about my work or seeing kind of like the purpose in what I was doing. So I really appreciated kind of being in the space to be with so many like introspective and passionate and humble people who are like willing to have these conversations.
Yeah, like Olivia herself, I was recommended by Masami. And again, anything Masami recommends, I listen to her. But, you know, I think it was exciting to see a dialogue centered around peace. I think when you work in policy, it's so easy to be jaded by the sorts of interventions that have worked and what hasn't. And in having this broad discussion about peace, I think there's sort of a posture towards the end goal being that peace is achievable. So I thought that was quite nice. But, you know, I think what excited me was the fact that many people came from different backgrounds, the participants of, and I don't think you really find that space quite often, because, you know, ultimately no one has like a knowledge monopoly on peace. And I thought that what a great way to approach this from multiple angles, you know? So that's what excited me. Yeah.
Yeah. I think just to both of your points, I don't think we expected what happened to happen as well. You know, we knew we were bringing all of you from different backgrounds together, but just like to share that space and sort of be centered around this idea of how do we create a society that is based on dignity and agency and caring about those who are suffering the most. And then seeing like the many resonances between the different works that you're doing, yeah, it was just really moving for me. And as you were both sharing too, I was just talking about this yesterday with somebody. We had hosted this seminar with this peace scholar who was like in her late 80s. And she was sharing with us, you know, she's been in peace work for like 30, 40 years of her life. And she shared with these youth that when she was young, she would go to these peace conferences and, you know, everybody was working for peace, but everybody was so focused on their own like niche or their own one issue or the one policy that they're trying to change. And like nobody was talking to each other. So everyone was so siloed and isolated, even though, you know, everybody sort of wanted the same end goal. Yeah, I was just thinking about that yesterday, just how it's so true, as you shared, John. We really don't have many spaces in our society to bring people together, you know, because, okay, well, what's the outcome? Like, who's going to get paid? Like, what's the agenda? You know, when maybe just the fact of like being together can create something that is really what we need at this time. So thank you both for sharing that. So yeah, do you feel like, I know we only had two set sessions, but are there things that you've sort of been thinking a little bit about since the seminar ended, or takeaways that you can share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think like when I first kind of saw the proposal title and it's like transforming human history, I was like, whoa, like how am I going to like find how what I'm doing kind of connects to this? So I think one piece of what I'm taking away from our conversation is kind of figuring out for myself to really define like what it means to contribute to the transformation of the current world into kind of this brighter future. And I think, you know, oftentimes our society likes to push a very narrow image of what it means to be a change maker, pushes us to kind of like quote unquote change the world in this really abstract and restricted and frankly sometimes like unachievable way. So I think like, you know, even if this is well very well intentioned, I think this messaging can isolate us from each other and really put constraints on like who has access to building the confidence that they can contribute valuable transformations. So I think that's been something that I've been thinking a lot about for myself and then also in my interactions with others.
Yeah. That, Olivia, reminded me, and I don't know if we read this together. I guess we didn't for this year's seminar, but the reason why the seminar series is called the Global Citizen Seminar is because it was inspired by Mr. Ikeda, who's the founder of the center, one of his talks or lectures that he gave at Teachers College in the 90s, and it was titled Thoughts on Education for Global Citizenship. And in it, he talks about what does it mean to be a global citizen. And so he talks about how it's not necessarily determined merely by the number of languages one speaks or the number of countries that one has traveled to. But he says in the lecture that I have many friends, he says, who could be considered quite ordinary citizens, but who possess an inner nobility, who have never traveled beyond their native place, yet who are genuinely concerned for the peace and prosperity of the world. And so I was just thinking about that. Even if we never go anywhere else, like, how are we contributing to peace where we are? And it starts from, yeah, I guess like this sort of inner realm of our lives almost. So yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really beautiful quote.
I guess I'll share one key takeaway from the seminar, being that it was nice to really have a good faith discussion about steps towards peace, devoid of some of the existing logics placed in our disciplines, for example, that would sometimes prevent us from seeing the beyond. And I think that, you know, what I got out of it is that despair is not an option, right? You ought to be, you know, doing peace building from a multidisciplinary approach. And really, I had not heard of the center prior to the seminar, and I had certain preconceived notions of what the dialogue might look like. But in fact, I think I found the experience to be the least ideologically bent. It was quite nice to have that experience where people are coming in sort of not in a blank slate, but, you know, everyone coming in with good faith and good intentions. Mm. Yeah,
thank you for the reminder, John, about the discussion around how despair is not an option. And then it makes me think of another kind of concept we talked about that, Olivia, I think you really resonated with, which was this idea of determined hope. And yeah, I wonder for both of you, I mean, for example, your work, John, you know, this idea of despair is not an option. I mean, I'm so for the work that you're doing, and it's actually something I think about all the time. And also when you were describing it, I was thinking, okay, but like, where do we even start with something like that? You know, like, how do we get people who deserve to be paid more paid? Like, do we start with the companies or do we start with the government? And then, you know, of course, Olivia, what you're doing with youth is not just something that can happen overnight. So I was wondering whether it's through the seminar conversation or just in your own personal lives, like, how do you not despair, you know, in the face of the work that you're doing? And how do you have like this sort of determined hope that I think Dr. Gula talked about, where hope is more of a decision than like based on our circumstances?
Yeah, I think if you're living in the moment, the despair can feel so intense. But if you ever want to put things into perspectives, you know, you talk to a historian and see that really in the grand scheme of things, what is felt right now is quite insignificant to actually what has changed over the centuries, decades. So, you know, speaking to my work, dignity, as it's tied to labor, you know, for what feels like a long time, that workers, especially those who work in the front lines, blue-collar workers, factory workers, manufacturing workers, have their dignity stripped away by certain measures, policies that have, you know, outsourced jobs abroad, decreased benefits, and so forth. And that has been the norm for quite a while, you know. But really, now you're seeing in the country a surge of labor movement, unionizations, people who have been pushed and told, you know, have their dignity stripped away, and only to have them now realizing that this sort of treatment is unacceptable. And they put aside their differences and they organized and formed unions to negotiate, you know. And I think that this sort of solidarity and keeping this dialogue option open is very refreshing. So that's those sorts of events, phenomena, give me a lot of hope that the work can be done, and sometimes gradually, but sometimes it could be quite sudden, especially, you know, the effects of the pandemic has shown. Yeah.
Thanks, John. I loved that. I love the idea of kind of looking back through time to kind of see the changes as a way to maintain and build hope. And it made me think about kind of something that I tell myself as a therapist when I'm working with a child and I try my best and they seem to be kind of functioning in the same way that they were at the beginning of our time together. And it can feel really disheartening. Absolutely. And then especially if, like, you know, I can't change certain contexts that they're in that's contributing to what they're coming in to see me with, see me for, rather. And I think something that I tell myself is, you know, I'm one snapshot in time in this, like, child's life. And, you know, maybe the intervention here is to have a positive connection with an adult, another person, you know, learning that, okay, maybe I can seek support, maybe I can get help. And it's just kind of making me think of trying to apply that to other aspects of our lives, of like, you know, this is one snapshot of time in history. And just because we might not be seeing these like grand changes that we want to see right now, that doesn't mean that we're not like creating a stepping stone for it to happen later on.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Olivia. And thank you, John. I think both of what you shared, yeah, I think it's very much in line with Mr. Ikeda's approach also to peace, of like this gradualist approach. I think even when you talked about history, John, the importance of like intergenerational dialogue, I think sometimes as young people, we can only see what we see now, and how just like everything's falling apart. But I think when I, even in our last podcast episode, we were talking to a friend of the center who's maybe a generation older than me, and we were talking about this idea of dialogue and how young people are really struggling right now with, you know, all these different issues that we're facing. And she was saying like, wow, when she was in high school, it was a whole different, you know, time. And she's seen how much things have changed. And it was so refreshing for me to hear that, because I really didn't feel that way, you know, until I was able to see her perspective, which is why I think dialogue is so important. So maybe, John, just touching on something you talked about in terms of dignity, one of the themes that came out of the seminar around global citizenship was that developing a sense of global citizenship involves a commitment to honoring the full dignity and agency of those among us who suffer the most and have experienced the most difficulties. So I know for our second session, we spend a lot of time on this, like thinking about dignity and agency in our respective work. So I was wondering if you can share a little bit, either from our conversation in the seminar or just now as you're looking ahead, how are you wanting to bring in more of that like dignity lens and work, you know, in with the people that you're interacting with and in your research?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to relate it to my research interests, I guess. I think on the surface, it certainly looks like I'm looking at occupational prestige as it pertains to pay. And really, it's about the value of work, how we are assigning value to work, which is a very crucial part of our lives. We work, you know, a third of our lives. So how do we... There needs to be meaning in that. But I think if you take a step back, really, it's also looking at dignity, right? Every job, every function in society should have a degree of dignity, and there should be at least a minimum, some sort of baseline dignity that is afforded to everyone. Just because you occupy a job that perhaps most people find undesirable, that doesn't mean that your living condition should be a reflection of that. I truly believe that the jobs that we have is part of a broader collective effort to progress us as a society. So yeah, really a lot of it is an interrogation on my own part, what dignity looks like in the form of labor valuation, if that makes sense, yeah.
When you think about dignity, in relation to labor, John, I think maybe it was another participant at the seminar who talked about dignity as something, right, that we inherently have. And when I think about dignity in the workplace, I often think about like, how do I experience or honor my dignity in my workplace, for example? Does that come from, you know, having some kind of structure that allows me to feel dignity in my work? Or is that, you know, something that, for example, company heads or like managers should be aware of and have some kind of like way of implementing dignity in all different kinds of types of work that we do? you know, I always think about how do we, where does dignity come from? Like, how do we feel dignity regardless of the work that we do or how society views the work that we do?
Yeah, so I do think that under the current configuration of labor, there are perhaps limited ways of looking at what dignity looks like, dignity in the workplace looks like. So, you know, I'm going the route of dignity as it pertains to compensation, but really there are multiple ways to look at that. But, you know, the way society functions right now is that the way you achieve some sort of stability, you know, dignity in your life is to have some sort of financial baseline that you feel comfortable with. And if that's how our society has valued work, then this is sort of the route I'm pursuing. But what I'm saying too is that in a work, there could be multiple forms of value. You know, there's the market value, which we're all used to, but there's really also the social value of work, right? For teachers, for instance, how really we can't quantify the long-lasting effects that they have on a student, you know, whether through their mentorship, through staying after class. So how do we get at that? And I think that requires, Olivia mentioned it earlier, some sort of cultural shift towards understanding this. And, you know, it's certainly possible. And I think that part of the solution lies in narrative change work. And sometimes that could be harder than coming up with specific metrics. People ought to realize, too, that their work does have some sort of inherent value and that they are contributing something to society.
Yeah. Olivia, I wonder, like, in your work with youth, and maybe we talked about this at the seminar, too, social workers who, yeah, I really feel like should be compensated the most in society, yet not only are they not compensated, you know, I think, how are they sort of maintaining their sense of dignity in their own work and their own mental health? And I was wondering if you've seen that struggle in the different spaces that you're part of, as you are so much involved in caring for or helping to nurture like a sense of well-being and dignity in young people or in people around you.
Yeah, thank you for that question. And yeah, I think maybe I'll answer with hopefully a compliment to these really important like structural changes and cultural shifts that need to happen. And just thinking from like an individual perspective, I think including in my kind of like nurturing roles, you know, I don't think that I or others can truly commit to like honoring the full dignity and agency of others unless we see it in ourselves and we really do believe that we hold it. And like you all are talking about, you know, we're like born with this inherent dignity and agency. And as time goes on, we're told that we don't have these things. So it does take a lot of work to kind of push back on those harmful messages that, you know, we've been programmed to have in our brains. I guess to get a little more specific, you know, by genuinely believing that like I have agency, maybe I can become more empowered to approach my interactions, whether that be with, you know, people in the therapy room and then also outside of it, kind of with the goal of honoring their dignity. So like if I don't feel that I have agency, like how can I possibly feel that I have a choice about how I interact with other people? And if I don't see my own dignity, like I might be more likely to allow others to humiliate me. And if that's the case, I might be more likely to allow others and their dignity to be humiliated by me or in my presence. So I think to kind of wrap up my thought here, you know, many of us, you know, kind of begin to forget that we have this dignity and agency because of like very real harmful experiences that try to make us small. And those experiences are like absolutely not our fault and we cannot control them. And at the same time, like what we can control is kind of our efforts to build back our relationships with our dignity and agency. And I think as we start to do this, we may also begin to more clearly see the humanity in other people, including those whose dignity and agency has just been consistently violated. So I think that's something that I try to prioritize as a therapist, someone who's trying to, you know, cultivate hope and agency and feelings of dignity and re-harnessing that in others, and then also for myself.
Thank you, Olivia. Thinking about it in that sense, it's reminding me that, you know, at the end of the day, each of us matter. You know, each person really matters. And Mr. Ikeda talks about in the same lecture at Teachers College, he feels that the root of all of the problems that we face, you know, in our world, whether they're divisions among people or issues of war, he says that the root of all of these problems is our collective failure to make the human being, like human happiness, the consistent focus and goal in all fields of endeavor. So he says the human being is the point to which we must return and from which we must depart anew. So if like we think about it from that perspective, I feel like what you just shared really makes that really come to life for me. Yeah. And, you know, kind of thinking about labor, John, it makes me think that there should be, in terms of transforming what labor looks like or what work looks like in America or in the world in general, I feel like there should be so many more dimensions to work, really like developing their full scope of their life versus just work is work. I know like we need work-life balance, but like what does that really mean? Maybe that's something to envision for the future. John, you can create a society where labor looks like that. So we'll entrust you with that task, John.
Well, that's a tall undertaking. I'm flattered, but I guess we also have to realize to what we're, I guess not to overinflate our egos as we're doing the work, because so many people are doing this work. And I think real change requires collective effort. And I think that's when it's most powerful. And it's been done and it's possible. So we should always remember that. Yeah. Things might look bleak, but it will change. Yeah.
Yeah. That is such a great reminder, John. And maybe this is a great segue to our next question, which is about dialogue, since this podcast is about the transformative power of dialogue. And I think Mr. Ikeda, you know, says something to the effect of when we engage in dialogue, that's where we can really find like hope for the future. And I think what you just shared, John, this belief that we're all working towards something, you know, together. And I think when we come together in dialogue, we realize these connections and we're able to hear the different stories and experiences of different people from different parts of the world doing different work. So yeah, I was wondering if you can both talk a little bit about dialogue and how that plays a role in both your professional work and also your personal lives. Like, how do you engage with others or how do you use dialogue to enhance the work that you do?
I would say dialogue plays a really vital role in my life. And I think it's reflected probably most prominently in kind of my goal to approach both my professional and personal life with curiosity. So I think it's really easy to equate dialogue with speaking with our voices, and that is certainly super important. People who know me well will tell you that I do it a lot. But at the same time, you know, the version of dialogue that I'm trying to practice is not as focused on speaking with my voice, but rather, you know, taking a stance of open-minded curiosity. And I think this can be communicated kind of through our body language, what our body's saying, by asking kind of open-ended questions, by really listening to and hearing what the other person is saying, not only what we're hearing through our kind of filter, but really what they're saying to us. And, you know, these are all skills that I practice as a clinician. And I also try to integrate this kind of curiosity-centered dialogue into other aspects of my life. And I think it can sound pretty intimidating to people, but I swear that you do it all the time. So, you know, even seemingly like simple questions, like when asked with genuine curiosity, like, how was your day? Can really open the floor, I think, for powerful connection through dialogue that we can often feel like we miss. I think it, you know, can come into play in other professional settings, for example, in mentoring or managing, and just asking someone straight up, saying, like, you know, some students thrive with more structure, like frequent deadlines and check-ins, whereas other students prefer much more flexibility, one big deadline that they're making progress on independently. Like, in what environments do you thrive? And just kind of opening the floor for that instead of just kind of expecting that everyone's going to be working the same way. In conflict, this is probably the toughest point for me, at least, to practice this kind of curiosity. And I find that it can be really powerful to even just start with saying, you know, what I'm hearing is X, like it made me feel Y. Can you help me understand like what you mean by X? And really trying to approach it with curiosity rather than letting our biases and our own really valid past experiences and viewpoints of the world kind of filter what we're seeing and hearing.
Yeah, I agree with Olivia. I think you said practicing curiosity, showing genuine interest. I think that's a huge component of having dialogue. You know, it's easy to say, I want a dialogue, but you come into a conversation with the intention of dismantling the other side, for instance, or coming with a set of talking points that you really want to push through. But I think it makes such a difference when the opposing side, or, you know, the person you're talking to, gets this genuine sense that you're trying to understand issues. And I think that really, you'd be surprised at the number of times that your mind has shifted, your orientation towards particular issues have shifted. I think it brings much more nuance and it adds so much more layers of dimension to the person you're talking to when you truly try to understand where they're coming from. So, you know, just speaking in my experience, when you're in the policy world, there's going to be so many different takes on a given set of problem, and each discipline, each concentration is siloed in their own mindset. But often we forget that, you know, ultimately we're trying to find solution. And I think collaborating with each other and understanding where each perspective is coming from is important. But also more importantly, the people whose this policy will be affecting, those are the people that we ought to be talking to and having this open dialogue with. So, yeah, and on a personal level, I think, you know, when you live with someone else, having constant dialogue is very important. I think it's just important to just lay out all your cards and believe that the other person is going to also similarly engage in good faith debate, which most often they are. Yeah.
Well, you know, so we are doing an event tomorrow night at the center for youth. It's our Dialogue Nights event, which is for college students and young professionals. And the topic we're exploring this month is the courage to listen. And we went out and interviewed some students in Harvard. And one young man said that he feels like the courage to listen is to have the courage to know that you might be wrong. And something that both of you said just reminded me of what he shared. And it also makes me think, like, a lot of times we do research without even really understanding the people we're doing research about. And I think that came up as well in our seminar. Yeah, this idea of dialogue, like, how do we have the courage to be able to hear, you know, these different perspectives? And how does that inform the work that we do? I think is something that doesn't happen, you know, a lot in our society. So yeah, I know we're kind of coming to the end of our dialogue time. And so thank you again for spending this hour with us. And we kind of did a little bit of this envisioning of the future. But talking to you both, really gives me so much hope about the future. And, you know, John, thank you for the reminders during this conversation that we are headed in the right direction. And Olivia, I'm sure you have that experience as you talk with youth. And yeah, we were wondering that, you know, as, you know, young scholars doing the work that you're doing now, what's something that you would like to see change in our world?
I think seeing more people show more humility is definitely going to be key. I think it's okay to course correct and change your mind. I think that's so often people are so ideologically committed to certain outcomes, let's say in policy, that they forget that life is very dynamic and you have to adapt to those changes as well. So yeah, a bit more humility in this world will do us good, I think.
I totally agree with that, John. Sounds like a great future that I want to be a part of. Yeah, I think kind of looping back to some points that I think we were making as a group earlier, is that I'd really like to see kind of an expansion in this definition of what we see as being a contributor to transformation, to transformative peace. For me, like, I genuinely do believe that my greatest purpose in life is in my kind of day-to-day interactions and how I approach those. And that includes, you know, personally, my loved ones, friends, but also professionally with colleagues, clients, and then just kind of throughout the day, you know, that person that I don't really know in the elevator, how am I interacting with you? And I think it gives me kind of that determined hope, knowing that, you know, if I am actively choosing to approach as many interactions as I can with kindness and the belief that every person holds dignity, then I am actually actively contributing to this idea of transformative peace. So I'd love to see kind of that shift in allowing people to have that confidence. Mm.